Today, is the financial stress worm finally turning, or is it eating its young? Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Well, in this post covering finance and property news, I've just completed my modelling to the end of May based on my household surveys, and today I want to walk you through the high-level results. Now, there's an important context here, of course, insofar that we know that, well, headline inflation was unchanged in April, according to the ABS data that came out recently, although the trimmed mean inflation actually inched up slightly to 2.8% from 2.7% in March. And it's interesting that commentators are now suggesting that the inflationary pulse is perhaps easing away and therefore more rate cuts are possible. Even Warren Hogan over at Juno Bank is quoted saying, "The worst fears I had that inflation wouldn't come down to 3% hasn't been borne out," before quickly adding, "It was certainly no victory." Now, the point I want to make is that, of course, that generic inflationary number doesn't really have much impact when it hits ordinary people, because different people are in different situations. What I can tell you is that there are many people who would say, "Oh, my costs are way higher than the 2.8 or thereabouts percent." And in some cases, we know that the costs of living are continuing to run away. And in fact, I made a show recently that highlighted that real income growth over the last decade is still not going in the right direction. And in fact, it's going to be many years before we see real income growth for many people. So it does beg the question then, so what's going on with regard to how household finances are actually shaping up at the moment? And of course, that's where my surveys come in. Now, there's an additional context as well, thinking about, for example, the high energy prices. There was an announcement that energy prices will be 10% higher or so for some people. That's because of the gas long con. You can see the report that I made the other day. And of course, other prices are rising. This is just one little one that's worth noting, that harbour tolls are up, and they're saying that it's helping particularly those in the West because they haven't seen so many rises and in fact have some subsidies. But the fact is that temporary toll is still there and going up. Now, because of the limited ability of some households to spend, one of the things that we are seeing is the household spending is somewhat lower. And in fact, this data from the ABS this week showed that if you look at total spending, it was down from the previous month. And interestingly, department stores and clothing were down the most, bit of food retailing, household goods retailing slightly up. And another way to look at it is in turnover terms, is that in New South Wales in particular, in the ACT, there was quite a drop, whereas in Queensland, there was quite a spike. Now, remember that this is not adjusted for inflation, and it's not adjusted other than looking at the total population. So if you divided per capita into this, given the fact we've got high levels of migration still coming in, per capita, retail spending continues to go backwards. Now, there was quite a lot of discussion earlier on about rate cuts and all the election vows from Labour would drive house prices higher. And this article from Shane Wright quotes HSBC chief economist for Australia and New Zealand, Paul Bloxham, and he highlights the fact that he thinks it's quite likely that we're going to see home prices up something like 12% in Sydney and Melbourne by the end of 2026. A strong demand, a lack of new housing, and cuts in official interest rates by the Reserve Bank encourage more people into the market. That, of course, is a problem because affordability is not great at the moment, as we'll see shortly. The latest auction results from Domain showed that clearances were pretty similar to last week, other than in Melbourne, where there was a little jump up. And the question, of course, is, are there more people now willing to step into the market? Well, maybe not, because if you look at the fundamental data on capacity to pay, you can see there that median home prices and capacity to pay continue to depart. And despite the recent rate cuts, it's very difficult for many people to buy. And this article just makes that point because it shows you how prices have moved. For example, in Castle Cove, it was sold in 1987 for $415,000. In today's money, that would be about $1.2 million. But in fact, it was sold in 2025 for $4.6 million. Well, there's your problem. But that isn't the full story. Spacious recently posted this, and over the last 12 months, many sold properties on the Sunshine Coast have seen prices 10 to 15% below expectations. We believe it's now the top of the market for the sunny coast. And that's one of the things that I'm seeing, that whilst there are areas where prices are still rising, there are other areas where prices are not actually rising and people are having to accept lower value for their property. A lot in and around Melbourne in particular. And I think that's going to be one of the reasons why we saw the clearance rates in Melbourne a little higher. So the question then is ahead, how this is going to play out is the big one. Are we going to see more rate cuts? Are we going to see household incomes growing? And therefore, what is this doing to household financial stress? Now, one other factor, of course, just as we get into this, it's worth thinking about, is the supply of new properties. The ABS data on approvals showed that the number of new residential building approvals in Australia fell 5.7% in April. That followed a 7.1% decline in March. And you can see there that typically it's the unit sector that's moving around a lot. And it's also worth noting, historically, about 94% of approved homes actually get constructed. And as Leith Van Onselen highlighted, and by the way, Leith's coming on my show, live show on Tuesday, the fact of the matter is that Albo's target is underwater considerably. And he looks at the State of the Housing Market Report of 2025 by the federal government's National Housing Supply and Affordability Council. And they suggest that there's going to be a shortfall around 262,000 dwellings. And that is how Leith showed it on the chart there in green. And then the final element is that we are still seeing housing credit pretty strong. So housing credit in the April 25 month was up 0.5% compared with 0.4% in March. And year ended, we're still seeing housing credit booming away at 5.8%, which is much higher than inflation or indeed wages growth. And it's also worth noting that broad money is still quite strong too. Now, when you actually stand back and think about all these things, two observations. This is from Canstar. The first is that now mortgage rates are somewhat lower, and in fact, there are some lowest variable rates out there at about 5.24%. And CBA, NAB and ANZ have dropped variable rates as promised. That will help millions of Australians with variable rate mortgages. But as I've highlighted before, in some cases, you have to go and approach the bank to make sure that they pass it on. On the other side of the fence, though, because of the lower rates, savings rates have got a haircut too. And we're seeing that in spades now. CBA, Westpac and ANZ each cut their interest rates on their key savings accounts by 0.25 percentage points. NAB already cut earlier. Now, of course, there are people with savings who rely on the interest on those savings, and now they're getting squeezed. So this is definitely not a one-way street with lower interest rates. It perhaps will give people greater capacity to borrow in some circumstances. But if you try and then put all this together and ask the question, so what is the impact of higher costs, inflation coming down slightly, lower interest rates beginning to flow through, lower returns on deposits, and some of those broader uncertainties in investment markets, how is that playing out down at the household level? And that, of course, is what my survey is trying to get to. Which takes us nicely then to remind you that when we do our analysis, what we're doing is we're surveying our households, and this is a rolling survey. We gather information each month and put it into our core market model. That information is then sliced and diced all sorts of different ways, so we can look at it across geographies, different segments, and different property status types too. In addition, we can take a view as to where things may go ahead, taking account of how some scenarios may play out, and we'll talk about those scenarios a bit later. So there's some sensitivity analysis too about what may happen ahead. But the core market model, in essence, takes the mortgage stress data from our surveys, the price trajectory and history on property, the buying and selling intentions from our surveys, migration data from the ABS and from our surveys and other sources, the economic data like CPI, wages, employment, and we put that all into the core market model, think about our different scenarios, and that allows us to look at the postcode level on a relative region, state, or all Australia level, and form a view as to where prices may run on a scenario basis. And at this point, I will just mention that we do provide a one-to-one service. So if you're interested in having a confidential discussion with me about a particular suburb or postcode, I can do that. This is not financial advice, but I can look at my data and looking at the underlying trends at a postcode or suburb level. And I can look at the stress data, the home price trends data, and also extract a view of where the trends may go ahead based on our modelling. This takes about an hour. It's a conversation via Zoom or phone. And there is a cost involved because I have to do quite a lot of background research, which is payable in advance. And we're booking 3 to 5 weeks ahead at the moment because we've got so many of these in the pipeline. A lot of people are trying to work out what on earth is going on. So if you're interested, if you go across to my blog, you can contact me then and I will provide you with some more information. Or indeed, if you go to the blog, you'll see there's a page called DFA One-to-One, and that gives you all the information and the questions that you need to consider. Which takes us back to our surveys, and particularly of stress. Now, we talk about financial stress or mortgage stress or rental stress, but it's worth noting how we think about it. So there are many definitions of stress out there. Mortgage stress is sometimes defined as 30% of income or perhaps taxable income. Others use underwriting metrics, but we define stress in cash flow terms, money in, money out. If households have more outgoings, excluding one-off discretion items and income, we define them as stressed. If they have a mortgage, they're in mortgage stress. If renting, then rental stress. And we can look at it for investors as well. Investors with cash flow pressures identified as stressed investors. And we can look at the data to estimate the total financial stress across all those categories. And we can look both in percentage of household terms and also counts. The latter is perhaps better because it gives you the law of big numbers, but we do cover both dimensions anyway. Now, the RBA some time ago published this little chart, which I do find very helpful because it talks about the spectrum of household financial stress from, on the left-hand side, their budget pressures via missing payments to ultimately insolvency. My surveys are measuring stress at the mild end, and as the intensity of financial stress increases, it can lead to insolvency, although actually insolvency rates are quite low at the moment because the banks are bending over backwards to try and help people. And this journey from mild to severe can take not months, but years. So the data to the end of May 2025, based on our surveys, shows that if we start with the rental stress has come down slightly. So we're now at 74.2% of all those in the rental sector across the country. And we were up at 77% at the peak, so that's come down a little. But you can see, compared with where we were in the early 2000s, it's way higher. And that's, of course, because we've seen rents, whether it's for houses or units, rise significantly higher than incomes, and in some areas, massively high. Perth is a particular hotspot at the moment. If we then go on and look at the mortgage stress data, we see that tipping down slightly to 49.8% of households. So just under half of households who have a mortgage are in mortgage stress. Now that compares with 32.9% in February 2020 before COVID. Oh, and we can also look at the RBA data on debt to income. And the last information that they provided was a ratio of 181.8. And that means that people have greater debts than income. And of course, that is spread across all households and small businesses. If you would just look at those with a mortgage, we're closer to 6 times average income. And in fact, there are still people having mortgages at 7, 8, and even 9 times income. So here is the latest data for May 2025. And I've highlighted in yellow where the percentage of households has risen compared with last month. And it's in the light blue color where they've dropped from last month. And you can see there in the ACT, mortgage stress has gone up to 41.5% and rental stress is up to 80.6% of households. And financial stress is up to 48.7%. And there's around 88,500 households in the ACT who have financial stress at the moment. That means they are having to pay out more than money coming in, and having to prioritise and perhaps borrow more or just not spend. In New South Wales, both mortgage stress and rental stress eased back, as did overall financial stress. In the Northern Territory, there was a bit of a divergence with mortgage stress going down slightly, but rental stress going up to 39.8%, around 13,000 households there. Overall financial stress was down a bit. Queensland saw a rise in mortgage stress, with more than 327,000 households in Queensland having cash flow pressures. But on the other hand, rental stress eased back slightly. Overall financial stress was higher, and 45.5%, that's around 911,000 households across Queensland. South Australia saw a bit of a decline this last month, at 48.4% in mortgage stress and 67.1% in rental stress, overall financial stress at 41%. But that's still more than 300,000 households across South Australia who have financial stress pressures. In Tasmania, we saw mortgage stress up to 58.7%, rental stress down slightly, investor stress down slightly, but overall financial stress, the aggregate measure, was up to 42.6%, which is around 99,200 households. In Victoria, mortgage stress fell, rental stress rose to 74.8%, and that's more than 556,000 households in rental stress. Investor stress also high, about 130,000 investors. That's one of the reasons why properties are coming on the market, with investors now trying to get out. And overall financial stress in Victoria was at 47.4%, more than 1.2 million households out of the 2.5 million households across Victoria. And in Western Australia, we saw both mortgage stress and rental stress coming back, although investor stress did rise slightly. And overall financial stress at 46.1% translates to 474,000 households in Western Australia. And the aggregate across the whole country showed that mortgage stress was down to 49.8%, that rental stress was down to 74.2%, but that still relates to 1.8 million households in mortgage stress and 2.3 million in rental stress. Stressed investors at 70.3% was around 521,000, and overall financial stress at 47% is 4.6 million households out of the 9.9, or let's say 10 million households across the country. So you can see here that households are still very much under the pump. And it's interesting that ACOS recently published some analysis which suggested that around 5 million households across Australia were in financial distress. So there's some interesting correlations with some of my numbers. Now, we can go into some more detail, of course, because the slicing and dicing of the data, a bit like a Rubik's Cube, allows me to look at different ways. So one of the ways we can look at it is through the different segments. And here I've just highlighted again that the highest levels of mortgage stress are in young growing families at 87.1%, and that translates to more than 280,000 households across the country. So unfortunately, a lot of the pressure are among young families, including many first-time buyers. So far as rental stress is concerned, there are whole different cohorts in difficulty, but the one that continues to stand out is the first generation Australians, the multicultural establishment, people who've come to the country directly into the rental sector, 83.7%, and that's about 196,000 in that particular category. Looking at investor stress, exclusive professionals and young affluents are the two segments that have the highest problems because they hold by far the largest proportion of investment properties. And aggregate financial stress, the average, is highest among young growing families at 65.9%, out on the suburban fringe at 60%, and then across various segments, including these multicultural establishment groups, as well as suburban mainstream, and very importantly, some wealthier seniors, as well as some of the stressed seniors. So the point to make here is that we are finding considerable pressure among different types of households, but really financial stress, although it's easing very slightly, it's at the margin. Now, what we can also then do is to dive into the specifics, and we'll look here at mortgage stress, and we'll just show you the top postcodes at the end of May for mortgage stress. So in postcode 2170, that's Liverpool, we had 13,400 households in mortgage stress. That's 96% of households in that particular area with cash flow shortcomings. Doesn't mean they're going to fall over tomorrow. Doesn't mean they're going to default, but they are having to prioritize spending and cut back. The next one is in Campbelltown 2560, and there pretty much all households are in difficulty. Up to Toowoomba 4350, with about 78% of households in difficulty or more than 11,800. And then we go to Western Australian postcode 6065 at Wanneroo, with about 11,500 households. Then Camden in New South Wales 2570, with more than 10,300. And then Victorian postcode 3805, including Fountain Gate and Narrowarren. Then Roxburgh Park and Donnybrook 3064, and Pakenham 3810, and Berwick 3806. All, of course, high growth corridors, a lot of new properties being built, a lot of highly leveraged people, a lot of first time buyers, and by the way, a lot of migrants there too, recent migrants in particular. Then we go out to Ballarat, Victorian postcode 3350, then Tarnit 3029, that's Hoppers Crossing and Tarnit. And then back to Sydenham in Victoria, 3037, Cranbourne, 3977, and then finally Pine Mountain, 4306 in Queensland. But you can see there a massive swathe of pressure in and around those growth areas around Melbourne. And that's where I think a lot of the pressures are, one of the reasons why we're seeing a lot of properties listed for sale at the moment. We can all look at risk of default. Now, this is my modelling based on what I'm seeing from my data as to what may happen over the next 12 months. And you can see there that Victorian postcode 3977 in Cranbourne has the largest count of risk of default at more than 1,100 households, followed by Mandurah in Western Australia, 6210 with 793, and then Armidale in Western Australia, 6112, and Success in Western Australia at 6164. Now, a lot of this is to do with what happened years ago, where we had a high run-up in house prices, a lot of lending, and then prices dropped. And whilst prices have recovered, there is a horrible pressure on many households who are still underwater now. Then we can go to 3064 Roxburgh Park in Victoria, Tarnit 3029, and also Derrimut in Victoria 3030. Then we go to regional postcode 4670, Bundaberg up in Queensland, and then Toowoomba up in Queensland, Wanneroo in Western Australia, Gosford, New South Wales on the Central Coast, and Mount Pleasant in the Mackay area up in Queensland, 4740. If we jump on and look at rental stress, we can see there that the highest count of rental stress is in Liverpool, New South Wales, 2170, with more than 14,700 households in rental stress, followed by the centre of Melbourne, postcode 3000, with 14,151, and Toowoomba, 4350, at 13,573. Westmead in New South Wales, 2145, with 11,500, and Southport up in Queensland, 4215, with again around 11,500. Campbelltown in New South Wales at 2560 is up there at more than 10,600. And then Derrimut and Point Cook, postcode 3030 in Victoria, followed by Zetland and Waterloo in New South Wales, 2017. Coomera in Queensland, 4209. Bundaberg in Queensland, 4670. Tarnit in Victoria, 3029. Mount Druitt in New South Wales at 2770. And Yatala up in Queensland at 4207, and Cranbourne in Victoria 3977. So you can see that there is some strong correlation between mortgage stress and rental stress, which is perhaps not surprising. Now, if we then look at stressed investors, so these are people who hold investment properties and have cash flow pressures, or indeed are trying to get shot of those investment properties. And it's interesting that Boondora in Victoria 3083 is at the top of the list with more than 4,600 stressed investors in the count there. Then we go to Sampson in Western Australia with more than 3,400, Toowoomba in Queensland, 4350, with more than 2,900, and then Narromburn, Crows Nest and Greenwich in New South Wales, 2065. Then we go to Hawarthara in Western Australia, 6532, Westmeath in New South Wales, 2145, Bundaberg in Queensland, 4670, Hornsbury in New South Wales, 2077, Maroubra in New South Wales, 2035, Southport in Queensland, 4215, and Benowa, 4217 in Queensland. And then back to Sydney with Surrey Hills 2010. And this is the aggregate financial stress results to the end of May. And you can see there that Liverpool, postcode 2170, is the top of the list. Three quarters of households in this particular postcode, more than 29,000, have financial pressures on them. Queensland postcode 4350, Toowoomba, at 59%, or more than 28,000 households have pressures. Next, we have Campbelltown, New South Wales, 2560, with 80% in financial stress. Point Cook and Derrimut at 3030, with 45.7%. Hoppers Crossing and Tarnet in Victoria at 46%. Cannons Creek and Cranbourne, postcode 3977, with 48%. Westmead and Constitution Hill and South Wentworthville, 2145, with 60%. And Roxburgh Park, Craigieburn, there around there, postcode 3064 in Victoria, at more than 52%. Ballarat in Victoria, 3350, is followed by Mount Druitt, including Bidwell and places like that in New South Wales. 80% have financial pressures there, more than 16,300. Then the centre of Melbourne, postcode 3000. Then Ipswich, postcode 4305, with more than 15,900, or 61.5% of households in financial stress. Then Wanneroo in Western Australia, 6065, with 62.4%. Pakenham and Upper Pakenham, Victorian postcode 3810, at 74%. And Churn Park and Labrador in Southport in Queensland, 4215, with 58.8%. That's the high-level analysis based on latest modelling to the end of May. And obviously, I will update this at the end of next month. Now, of course, we also do have more granular information. And here is just the standard example. This is for postcode 2500 in Wollongong. And you can see there that in this particular postcode, we look at the household count at more than 19,200. We can see that 48% are renting and 23% are borrowing. We can see that mortgage stress is a third of households, but rental stress is at 72%. And we can also see that there are a combination of houses and units in this particular area. We can also see that the vacancy rates are relatively high, but the gross investment yield at 3.4 is okay, but the net investment yield, which is actually the real touchstone for an investment property, is underwater by 1%. So there are many investors losing their shirts at the moment in this particular postcode. In terms of average taxable income, 71,000 from the ATO data on an individual basis, and 84,200 from the census data on a household basis. And the multi-flag is there because you can see that that means that multiple incomes are going to pay the mortgage. And that translates to a disposable monthly income around $5,900 for the average of households in this particular postcode, with 41.7% going to pay the mortgage, more than $2,467, and 33.7% at $1,993 going on the typical rent. And we have this information available for every major postcode across the country. And if you're interested in grabbing the data for a particular postcode, there's a few ways you can do it. Firstly, if you put the postcode in the comments below, I'll then make a subsequent show where I'll walk through this information on the postcodes that you're interested in. Or you can send me a message via the DFA blog, and if you ask for a specific postcode, I'm happy to send you the one-page summary. Or if you're interested in getting information for more than 2,000 postcodes updated each month, that's available via our Patreon program at $50 a month plus GST. And I'll show you some information on how to get to that later, or you can look in the comments below. So there are various ways if you're interested in this data. And of course, once you start looking at different areas, you can make some comparisons between households in one postcode versus another postcode, which may help when it comes to searching for property or making financial decisions around property. But I'm not providing financial advice, I am just providing data. Now, the other angle on this is our scenarios, because of course, the scenarios are a way of exploring alternative futures, and none of them may be right, but it shows you some significant sensitivities. And of course, today, given the uncertainty around tariffs, I think this is really valuable. In fact, I made a show earlier on when I talked about the Reserve Bank of New Zealand's scenarios, where they looked at a negative supply shock globally, creating higher uncertainty, or a more negative global demand shock and higher uncertainty, and how those things played out quite differently in terms of potential outcomes for growth and for prices. If you want more information on that, go across and look at Kiwi's Get Another Rate Cut, But Will Home Prices Respond? My conclusion was probably not, by the way. Anyway, if you look at the scenarios, I've got to my three that I run, my Goldilocks zone. So I've got rate cuts in May, and we expect more later in the year, along with the RBA estimations, while inflation eases in line with them as well. Wages rise faster than inflation, but we don't get a recession in Australia, but strong migration supports the momentum. The base case is a softer landing. We've got the 3.85%, and it will stay there until September 2025, while inflation falls but does rise again later and stays above target until 2026. We don't get a recession locally, but we see migration easing back. And the worst, the nightmare scenario, is that we see rates at 3.85%, but inflation steps up, unemployment rises, and wage growth falls in the second half. And it's really to do with the second order trade-led recession in Australia. We see rates cut later, migration drops below average. So those three, and they are just examples of different scenarios, I could run other ones, shows you what may happen. So if we take, for example, the overall Australian home price scenarios for May, in the best case scenario, over the next 3 years, we have a view that house prices could be up 11% cumulative, 3 to 4% over the next 12 months, a further few percent next year, and a bit more the year after, making 11% overall. On the base case scenario for houses, there's a small fall over the three-year period. And of course, if things went pear-shaped considerably, prices could drop considerably too, with the worst case scenario, a 20% fall over 3 years. Units tend to follow on quite closely, perhaps a little less sensitive to the downside because of the somewhat higher demand for units, particularly in around Sydney. Now, I do actually run these models for every state, but I'll just show you a couple. Western Australia, still quite strong. The best case scenario, a rise of 17.8% over the next 3 years. That's cumulative. The base case, still a rise of 2.7% over 3 years, and the worst case, a fall of 17% over 3 years, and units following along pretty close. In New South Wales, the best case is a scenario of 10% over the next 3 years, or a base case of a small fall around 5% over 3 years, but actually most of that fall happens in the first 2 years, and nothing much happens in year three. On the worst case scenario, there's quite a considerable fall though, more than 24% over 3 years, and units follow on quite close. Compare that with Victoria. So the Victorian scenario is the best case, up 4.2% over the next 3 years. The base case is a fall of 10.8% over 3 years, and the worst case, a fall of 30% over the next 3 years, and units tend to follow on. So that brings us to the end of this brief analysis. And my summary is households are still under the pressure pumps at the moment, and we are still seeing the amount of financial pressure are eating, particularly younger families and households who are going backwards in terms of income and whose costs are rising very hard and who probably won't be able to take much benefit from any rate cuts that come through in the short term. I think that this is going to be a painful time over the months ahead. Remember that inflation hasn't gone away. Remember that the income tax take is still higher because the bands have frozen. And the chances are the Labour government will need to put taxes up ahead too. So it's not looking very pretty. Now, if you are in financial difficulty and you have financial pressures, it's important to understand them and not just hide away from them. Unfortunately, quite a few people in my surveys do put their head in the sand and say, she'll be right. Well, maybe they won't be right. So it is important to understand where the money's going, money in, money out, build a cash flow, prioritise, and look specifically at any outgoings with high interest rates attached. Now, if you need to get help, you can, and be careful if you Google financial help or something similar, because you can be led up the garden path. But I recommend the National Debt Helpline, 1-800-007-007. And those financial counsellors, government-backed, of course, are able to provide some significant support. And I do recommend that as a source of support if you need somewhere to get some help. Of course, you can also talk to your bank, but remember the bank will be trying to look after their interests, not your own. And sometimes the recommendations that I see coming back from the banks are actually very self-serving. There's also this very important AFCA Statement of Financial Position document, which is available online from the AFCA site. And this allows you to plumb in the borrower details, the household income, the living expenses, the property data, other assets, debts, and your proposal, and whatever review you want to add to it. And this can provide a really useful tool to facilitate a conversation with your bank if you have financial pressures. So I do recommend making the time to put the story together properly to be able to be convincing. Now, just before I go, I will remind you again that I do provide various ways to access my services. This includes support via Patreon, and there are different tiers. Thank you for all those who continue to support it. We really do appreciate it. It makes a huge difference to us. If you're interested in getting the latest stress data, as I said earlier on, $50 US plus GST a month, then feel free to contact me or go direct to the Patreon site. The links are below. You can see there, patreon.com/digitalfinanceanalytics, and you can sign up there. And within 24 hours or so, I can send you the full data set. And you can subscribe for as long as you want. For as long as you are subscribed, I will send the updates typically around the middle of the month. The reason for that is that what I do is this initial summary at the start of the month. And then once I've done that, a few weeks later, I'll then run a live show where I'll go into some of the analysis. And then from there, I'll send the information out for everyone to use. So that information is available now. And if you want to subscribe as a new subscriber, go via Patreon and I can send you the data immediately. So that's it. Thank you very much for spending some time with us today. I hope you found this interesting. I think the bottom line statement is simply this, that all of the hopium around rate cuts and how it's going to fundamentally shape households' financials into a better shape is probably overdone. There are lots of factors to still play out. And certainly we see a significant proportion of households across the country in significant financial pressure, and in some cases with little in the way of options ahead. So if that is you, it is important to get the right help. I made some suggestions earlier on about what to do and how to do it, and also prioritize effectively. And it's really important to understand that this is not likely to change anytime soon. The government doesn't have the facility to bail everybody out, and the chances are that inflation will still bubble a little higher than they would want to see it for the next few months. So this is a very awkward time for many households. And the bottom line for me is simply this: understand your status, select and prioritize the really important things, and ask some hard questions about the rest. It's not a hard recipe, really, but it is tough to execute. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.